From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide. It's available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, March 14th was the one-month anniversary of the mass shooting at a school in Parkland, Florida, that claimed 17 lives. As threatened in the face of inaction by our elected representatives on the issue of school safety, students walked out across the nation. They were joined by supporters and activists in countless cities, and interfaith groups organized candlelight vigils and other public actions. NRA fanatics have been loudly claiming the students are naive and misguided. But it appears that it may be the pro-gun lobby that those adjectives actually apply to, because they assume too quickly that national attention to gun safety will quickly fade. It always has in the past. 1 month in, though, there's no sign of that happening. And on Saturday, March 24th, millions are expected in the nation's capital for the March for Our Lives. One of the tragic casualties of the deafening noise news cycle we're all subjected to these days is the ability to even process important stories that don't have the word Trump in them. Such is the case with a series of bombings that have terrorized Austin, Texas this month. Two African-American men have died. 17-year-old honor student and promising musician Draylon Mason was killed by a package bomb on his front porch. And Anthony House, 39, a senior project manager who worked for Texas Quarries, lost his life in a similar way. Terrifyingly, both victims are close relatives of prominent Austin civil rights leaders. And there was widespread criticism of the administration's choice to replace Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who was abruptly voted off the island this week. Although Mike Pompeo already has a powerful role as head of the Central Intelligence Agency, his extremist views would be far more influential at the State Department. Whether the fact that he has promoted the idea that a global death match is underway between Islam and Christianity, or that his nomination is being celebrated by the hate group Family Research Council as a sign of, quote, a return to American values and principles, or that Human Rights Watch is alarmed over his past endorsement of torture, or that he is an outspoken skeptic on global climate change, we're waiting to see if Senator Rand Paul follows through on his threat to block Pompeo's confirmation. And if so, who on earth this president will nominate next? Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Time makes ancient good uncouth, said James Russell Lowell. Then the people that can't adjust will adjust. It takes time, but it never moves backwards. So I would say we live into whatever the future will be. I'm not going to engage somebody who wants to argue about whether doctors should bleed patients to get rid of infections in their, because demons are in their bloodstream. Now, those things just disappear. And this will disappear, and we'll be in a much happier place. And a better world, a better world.
It was nothing less than a highlight of my years hosting State of Belief Radio. Retired Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong, a fearless faith leader and articulate dissident for decades, a prolific author and a hero to so many, was sitting across his dining room table from me, leaning forward and earnestly describing how different, how incredibly different his understanding of faith and inclusivity was today versus a half century ago. The conversation lasted most of an hour, and the video is available online at stateofbelief.com. Now 86, Bishop Spong has just written yet another remarkable book. The title is Unbelievable. No, the title really is Unbelievable. Why neither ancient creeds nor the Reformation can produce a living faith today. And he joins us once again on State of Belief Radio. But first,
things about fake news, about all kinds of stuff.
Do you have any fake news in Rwanda?
Or is I think the whole world has. Yeah.
That was just fake news by NBC, which gives a lot of fake news.
The media is biased. It's fake and it's biased and it's wrong.
They are bad people.
They're among the most dishonest people I've ever met in my life.
Total phonies.
They're bad people.
Undermining the integrity of journalism, whether by the creation and distribution of stories that are just untrue, or by calling true stories that one doesn't like fake news, there can be no way of denying that great damage is being done, even as there can be no way to yet measure the ultimate consequences of this damage. Think of something as simple as the weather forecast. Could you become convinced that the TV weatherman owns stock in an umbrella factory and therefore predicts rain out of mendacious self-interest? And if someone could convince you of this being true, you would never really believe the forecast ever again, right? So now multiply that simplistic example by the gravest of life or death issues on this planet. It ultimately becomes less important what the motivation behind the undermining of trust in real journalism is, and critically important to recognize what is happening, how it impacts our understanding of the world around us, and how to begin to fight back. With a particular focus on how we find out what we find out about matters of faith today, the Washington, D.C. institution, the Newseum, includes an invaluable Religious Freedom Center. Leading the center since the start of the year is the Reverend Kristen Looney, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Do you see what I've just talked about as a big problem?
Absolutely. I believe that freedom of press, freedom of speech are intricately tied to our basic beliefs. And so for many of us, that's religious freedom. That's freedom of conscience. But if we can't express our deepest beliefs, if we're not able to express these values that we hold, if we're not able to express them in public, if we're not able to express the many different perspectives that we have in our American fabric, then we're not going to be able to tackle some of the most intractable issues that are facing our nation and our global community. And so we need to be able to have vehicles to be able to express our deepest beliefs and to be able to engage with each other about them.
I'm just curious as to how much of a challenge you felt taking on this responsibility, knowing the kind of changes that we have been through and the challenges that we now have.
Well, luckily at the Newseum, we have the First Amendment Center and our Newseum Institute. And so we have experts here in the building that have really been dealing with these issues for 20 years, 20 plus years. And so although these issues are very current to us, we're feeling them in our different communities, we have experts here who are helping us navigate these issues. So very grateful for my colleagues in this. I know as news journalists are becoming more generalists, it's hard for them to have specific training and really be able to address specific issues, especially within the different religious communities and within the secular perspectives as well. And so that's one of the issues that I've specifically heard from religious communities, is that reporters are not able to give the full context and the nuanced issues that the different religious and secular communities are facing in our country. And I think that's an issue.
Do you see faith traditions that are being particularly impacted right now by how easy it has become to simply dismiss unwelcome news reports as fake?
Well, I think we certainly have seen a rise of Islamophobia. We certainly have seen that, and there are many watchdog organizations that are tracking that. And I think that is a huge issue. And I think that leads to one of the other issues that we see, is that we are a deeply religious nation, and yet we are religiously illiterate as a general population. And so that is very difficult, I think, especially as we become, especially as the religious landscape has changed in the United States so dramatically. If our leaders have not become and are not religiously literate, it's hard for them to help communities navigate these changes in their communities. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that we're facing now. And I think because of that, that's one of the reasons why we're seeing a rise of religious intolerance. And we're hearing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing statistics playing that out across the nation.
Kristen, I'd like to talk about your work at the museum. First of all, congratulations on the executive director position you took on this past January. Please tell our listeners about the Religious Freedom Center. When was it founded? Tell them what they need to know about it.
Sure. It's a remarkable place, and I hope that anyone who comes to visit D.C. will take an opportunity to come here. What's unique about the space, this building was built in 2008. It's located right on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so if you go up to the sixth floor terrace, you can look out and see the U.S. Capitol. And then you know that we're located right between the Capitol and the White House. And then you can also see a little bit of the Supreme Court. So what's important about this location is that Pennsylvania Avenue is known as America's Main Street. And so as we are doing our work here at the Religious Freedom Center day in and day out, we remember that the work that we're doing here on American Main Street is representing the main streets across America. So when we're working for religious freedom, we're educating educators and administrators of school systems. We're working with business leaders. We're working with religious and civic leaders and equipping them and helping them to feel confident and competent and really engaging in these issues in their community. We are reminded that we're sitting here on American's Main Street and how powerful that is. And we're also reminded that, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue has been this place where marches and protests and demonstrations have happened, where people for 200 years have gathered to fight for these freedoms. And so it's a remarkable place, and I invite you to come here. Since it opened, we've had over 7 million visitors. We have incredible exhibits which focus on all five freedoms, and we're just coming up to our 10th anniversary.
I wish you'd also tell our listeners about some of the resources that you offer the public.
We work with many different leaders. Our goal is to be a nonpartisan, non-sectarian organization. And that's very, very important to us because it's important that we invite all people, all voices around the table, and that we are a place, a safe place, to broker difficult conversations around religious freedom and other issues that are really tearing our communities apart. We offer professional development for educators, for religious leaders, and civic leaders. We offer executive business seminars for businesses on how to create a religiously diverse and inclusive workplace. We host workshops and public events around the important religious liberty issues that are facing our communities. And so we are trying to really engage with the public, to educate the public, and to really equip them with the skills that we all need to be able to deal with a lot of these issues that are facing our communities. I think another important piece that we're really building out right now is we're starting to train leaders on the skills of civil dialogue, because we realize that there are very few places where organizations are being very intentional about bringing people together of different perspectives and really listening and learning from one another. We've become such polarized communities that one of the biggest pieces that I think we can offer is training our religious, civic leaders, educators, business leaders on the skills of civil dialogue. And so they can be intentional about providing these places within their communities to really learn about each other in a way that is going to help, hopefully, find that common ground, which then people will be able to work towards and solve some of the biggest issues facing our country.
Christian, I'm curious, what drew you to this work? You're an ordained Episcopal minister. You've held pastoral positions in several cities. What made you decide this was the important work that you needed to be doing right now?
Thank you for that question. I was raised in the church. My grandfather was a minister, and I definitely felt called to the ministry, and I enjoyed my work in parishes. I learned a great deal. My bishop at one point in my career, my Episcopal bishop, asked me if I would be willing to be a chaplain for schools, and so I held chaplaincies for a number of years. And while I was engaged in chaplaincy, I ended up being, you know, the spiritual leader in these schools for an interfaith community. And that was the most difficult, but also the most rewarding work. And I realized that was really my call, was to help our communities. And oftentimes I feel that our communities are being torn apart because we don't understand each other. We don't know about each other. We don't respect people who have different beliefs than ourselves. So working within the interfaith community became very important to me and the work that I've done. And so this role has given me an opportunity to really kind of frame all of that work in a civic framework, reaching out to the public and reminding and educating people about the First Amendment, that we are all promised this freedom. We are all given this freedom, this inalienable right for freedom of conscience. And we are protected in that. And I see that as one of the biggest issues facing our country right now. And that matches one of my biggest passions. And so I feel very honored to be able to do this work with the many, many colleagues that I have.
The Reverend Kristen Looney is Executive Director of the Religious Freedom Center at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. You can learn more about the center's work at religiousfreedomcenter.org, and we'll link to that website from stateofbelief.com. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief, and know we want to support you.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful pleasure and an honor.
Up next, the author of the new book, Unbelievable, Why Neither Ancient Creeds Nor the Reformation Can Produce a Living Faith Today, retired Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spong. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Unbelievable. Why neither ancient creeds nor the Reformation can produce a living faith today. That's the title of Bishop John Shelby Spong's latest book, and I am delighted to have the author with us once again on State of Belief Radio. Bishop Spong, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
At what point in your life, did you realize that changes had to be made, that the Christianity you had been taught was not the Christianity you believed and wanted to know more about? When did that happen?
It came in waves, actually. The first wave was that I grew up in the South in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I heard all sorts of justifications of segregation. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And that challenged me to begin to look at the symbols of the Christian faith in a brand new way. It developed later when my daughters began to be teenagers, and I suddenly looked at the way the church had treated women. And it didn't sound right to me. And so it drove me back to the scriptures and back to the faith in a brand new way. And finally, there was a time when my early Episcopal career when I took notice of the fact that the church treated homosexuals with terrible impunity, and that didn't sound right to me. It didn't feel right. It didn't jive with what I knew about homosexual people. And so into a study I went and came out a couple of years later with a brand new theology of inclusivity that included gay and lesbian, transgender people. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that no matter what stand I wanted to take, I had to fight the Bible as presently understood, and I had to fight the church as it articulated its faith. And those things just required me to think. Now, one thing you can do is to give up the Bible and the church at that point when they show that they so little understand. And the other thing you can do is you can go more deeply into them than you ever have before. Mm. And for reasons I don't fully understand, I decided to go into them deeply. And what I've come out with is a Christian faith that is wide and broad and deep and beyond all of the categories of church talk and Christian traditionalism. Yeah. And it's been a wonderful ride. I'm 86, and that's the last book I'm going to write, and it's a good one to finish my work with.
I've heard this is the last book before.
In September of 2016, I had a stroke, and it made it almost impossible for me to write. And I broke my arm about 2 weeks ago, and that put an end to anything I might want to write.
I see. You know, it's troubling to me that out of the ashes of the epics you identify in the book's title, there has come a powerful political, nationalistic Christianity that seems to have very little to do with the teachings of Jesus. In other words, the thoughtful theology that you and I occupy ourselves with seems to thrive in scholarly environments, but what marches in the rhetorical streets is a very different kind of Christianity indeed. How much does that matter?
Well, I don't know that it matters a great deal, but that is a true observation. But religion is, first of all, it's a human enterprise, and it covers up very deep insecurities in human lives. And you give up those insecurities only after they lose their meaning, and you fight hard to make sure they don't lose their meaning. And so Christianity is always in a rear guard action against modernity. And we've gotten to a point where in today's world, the gap is wider and wider. You can hardly be Christian in a traditional sense and where I am. So I challenge deeply the traditional belief of Christians, and they are surprised to find out that I claim an absolute devotion to the Christian faith and to Jesus as my Lord. That doesn't ring true with them. Mm-hmm. In the national scene, evangelical Christians seem okay with Donald Trump, despite his morality, despite his lack of truthfulness, despite all the things that go on about his life. I don't know how they stand to do that. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Christian faith got more integrity than that, but it's a solid block of people, and he seems to draw them to him because he is a strong man and makes the defense of what they believe seem logical.
You write that neither ancient creeds nor the Reformation can produce a living faith today. So what can?
Well, I think it's a deep inquiry. It's certainly not the traditional creed. That's a 4th century product. And the way we thought in the 4th century has been just totally abandoned. We used to talk about the God above the sky. That God makes no sense to us today. We know that above the sky is our galaxy, and that's a very big galaxy, bigger than many people thought when the creed was built. The galaxy we live in, it takes light 100,000 years to go from one end of our galaxy to the other, traveling at 186,000 miles per second. And that's just one of billions and billions of galaxies. Above us is galaxies, suns, stars, black holes, dark matter, but there's no God there. So the projection is that if you can't locate God somewhere, God's difficult to locate anywhere, and that's where we are today. It's difficult to think about God today because all of the ways we've talked about God in the past have simply vanished. And they vanished because we got higher knowledge about how this world operates and what constitutes this world, and you can't correlate that with Christian faith. Mm-hmm. We used to say things like, man is created in the image of God, and we usually said man too. Human life is created in the image of God, and that was a sacred symbol. But we know now that human life has evolved over millions of years of evolutionary history. Human life is somewhere between 6 million years old and 250,000 years old, depending on how you define human life. And none of that can be translated into the categories of the Bible. The first book of the Bible wasn't written until 1000 B.C. It's a very late book in human history. Of course, we didn't write for most of those years. We've only been able to write since about 12,000, 15,000 years ago. And so everything we know about the Bible is limited in time and space, and we cannot escape that. Mm-hmm. So we've got to begin to think in a vastly different way. When I was in seminary, I read a book, I've forgotten the author's name, but it was entitled Your God is Too Small. It was J.B. Phillips. We thought that was a great book, and it was a terrible book, but it had a great title, and that's what we need to be aware of today. The God of human beings, the God of men and women, is today too small to be God of this universe, and if we can't find a way to let God grow into the fullness of what God is, then there's going to be nobody that will pay attention to this God.
You know, dogma can be so dangerous, but it also can serve a stabilizing purpose. When people of faith are driven away from structured, organized religion, whether by what's happening in religion or what's happening in their individual spiritual maturation, how can they avoid falling into misguided and even self-serving belief systems?
Well, I don't know. I wish I did. The millennials, there are more people that answer the question, what is your religious background, as nothing than any other thing in the whole vocabulary. More than Roman Catholics, more than evangelical Christians, more than Presbyterians. Nothing is superior. And if you go to the generation beyond the millennials, it's just almost unknown to be active in the life of the Christian church. So that we're fighting a losing battle on the old ideas, and nobody seems to care much. We want to fight to preserve those old ideas, and we continue to do it. I think most people who go to church today are dishonest. I think they don't really believe the things they say, but they can't say that out loud because they have no alternatives and they can't afford to give up the whole religious tradition.
Hmm.
I go to church every Sunday that I'm able, and I have very good friends in the church, but they're not particularly religious people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting.
You have said and written that Christianity must change or die. I have to admit that I question whether or not it will die. Some form of Christianity seems like will persist, even though it is far different from the Christianity we see in the Bible and the Christianity to which you are pointing us. I question whether what passes for Christianity today is a faith that deserves to be called Christian.
I think that's true, and where it affects me is that they continue to suggest that I'm not a Christian, because the confines of that belief system are simply wouldn't allow a person like me to be in it. Let me say that I have a good friend who's 100 years old, and he's in New Zealand. His name is Lloyd Gehring, and he's written a very fine series of books over the years. In the 1950s, he was put on trial by the Presbyterian Church for heresy, and he was found innocent, and the Presbyterian Church died in New Zealand. It was an interesting process. But Lloyd looks at the transition in history, and he says what we need to recognize is that secular humanity is a child of the Christian faith. And if we could just go back and find some rooted system to put under secular Christianity, what's missing is the rooted system simply wasn't designed to hold up the power of that. I think that's a clue to the future.
Hmm.
An English theologian named Don Cupid has written a series of books. One is Taking Leave of God, and another is Above Us, Only the Sky. And he's doing the same thing, that the old ideas do not translate, and we've got the faith tradition without any religious underpinnings, and we've got to find a way to put the underpinnings under it, but they're going to be vastly different.
So what will it take for people satisfied with traditional orthodoxy to realize the need for changes and the spiritual courage to explore changes?
Well, if they really are convinced of that, they won't do it. I think what we've got going on is that most people are not convinced of that,
mm-hmm.
and they have to find something. But that's when I say most people don't want to discuss this, because they're sure that if they discuss it, what they believe will disappear. And so they sort of blankly say the creeds every Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and don't ever raise questions about it. If you get a church where the minister wants to raise questions, he's not likely to make it. He will undercut the security system of those people. We live in a world where it's going to take ministers of brave courage to chart out into the distant, mm-hmm. into the unknown future. But that's what our faith is about. Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees to start a new faith out in the wilderness that never was known before. We always are leaving the known for the unknown. What faith really means biblically is the ability to leave what you know for what you do not know, and the confidence that you're going to find God in some form when you get there.
Language is a big problem, or so it seems to me. Tillich stopped talking about God and spoke of the ground of being, a change in language that made people aware that change was occurring. You seem comfortable in using traditional language filled with non-traditional meaning, filling out the words, the old words. You speak of your comfort with Trinitarian language. That whole last part of your book I found so interesting. But when you say you believe in the Trinity, what you believe is monumentally different from what other people mean by the Trinity. What do we do there?
You need to recognize that words are time-bound and time-warped. And there's no such thing as a word that will not lose its original meaning if it lives long enough. What the Trinity meant when the church adopted it, it was an attempt on the part of the church to define God. Well, you can't really define God, but they defined God in symbols that they knew, and then they literalized it and made the Trinity a doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the Trinity is a statement of a human attempt to explore God, and that's all. I believe that God is above everything I know, and that's Father. I believe God is deeply within me, and that's the Spirit. Mm-hmm. And I believe God communicates to me through other human beings, and that's the Christ figure. So I don't mind saying that the words of the Trinity explain my definition of God, but they don't explain God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great big difference, a huge difference,
sure.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah. What part of Christianity presented the most difficult struggles for changes to occur in you?
I think it was probably the Christ figure. I have a great devotion to the Christ figure, as the New Testament reveals him. But I don't take literally anything in the Bible. I don't think the Bible ever says that Jesus is God. It says Jesus is who God is. Jesus reflects God in his life. And you then try to figure out what that means. And what I think it means is that Jesus reflects a life that is found when you give your life away. And to be able to give your life away, you've got to possess your life. And when you give your life away, you're acting in a godlike fashion. That's what being does. Tillich is my great mentor of all the theologians in the 20th century. Tillich I hold in highest honor for his thought. And it was not God who is a being that rescued me. It was God who is the ground of being, and I can't even explain the ground of being.
Sure.
But it's a substance underneath every definition of God that I use. It's the substance that's underneath all the definitions of the religious world that I use.
You have been so incredibly helpful in people understanding Christianity in a new way and finding a new devotion to Christianity. Are the changes that you see must occur for Christianity to survive applicable to other religions so that if they don't change, they don't survive?
I think that's correct, although I wouldn't say that I know enough about Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam to be an authority on that. But every religion is born in history, every religion. It might be clouded around its origins, as Buddhism and Hinduism are, and might be a little more specific, as Islam and Judaism and Christianity are. But they were born in time and space. There's no such thing as a human explanation that is eternal. Every human explanation depends on the words that you use every day, and they've been transformed by the development of science over the years so that we can't use the same words. I don't understand why that isn't essential to people. So I cling to the meaning behind the words, and I give up the words. I keep searching for a new way to talk about what the word God means, a new way to talk about what the word Christ means. I see a great need for a church where people can be who they are and come together to celebrate life and explode life, expand life. That's not what most churches are doing. Most churches are covering up their activities with guilt and fear and keeping them sort of marching in a straight line because they can't afford to get outside that line. I don't think that the traditional religious virtues of any religion are eternal, and I don't know what the future will be. I came closest to defining it in my new book, in the last chapter called Universalism. I think that in the last analysis, Christianity must lead us to the place where we take every person for who he is, whether he's male or female, black or white, gay or straight, transgender, or any of the other things, and see him for what he is and embrace him. And that's going to be a brand new way of living. I don't know that it'll be the church that holds them together, but I hope it will be. I hope that we'll recognize church in that institution. And I don't think it's going to occur tomorrow. But there's a sense in which the present administration in America is a sign of the bankruptcy of all the meanings in the past, because we've got a man in the White House who does not share any of the virtues of the religious past and who gets a free ride from the evangelical of the world, who continues to support him on some basis.
One thing that you and I share is a public journey, an out loud evolution in our beliefs that has receive both condemnation and appreciation. I know I sometimes get frustrated that there are many people of goodwill who may be at a place today that I was at 20 or 30 years ago.
Exactly.
I know
right.
People move forward at their own pace, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on how this moving forward takes place.
Well, I think, first of all, that we ought to accept as a virtue every person that moves forward. Well, they move from Adam and Eve to just a little bit away from fundamentalism. That's a step forward. That's a step toward wholeness. That's a step toward universalism.
Mm-hmm.
And we ought to be glad for that. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't know what to do with the church, because in a parish church, you've got people at every stage of development. If you force them to move faster than they can move, they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a sinful thing for us to do. We got to love those people for what they are and for what they have. It took me a long time to see that, but I was in Tarboro, North Carolina once, and the racism was as sick as it could be. But behind the racism, those people were good and honorable people.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wrestled with being good and honorable people. And I didn't appreciate that then. I do now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens is they die. And their children adjust, and their grandchildren adjust. I had one member of my church in Tarboro where the father was just adamantly opposed to me. I'm coming to the point where I thought on one occasion he was going to hit me.
Hmm.
And then his son came back from college and lived there, and the father died. And the son invited me to dinner. And he said, I wanted to have you because I wanted you to know that I know that you were right in the conflict with my father. But he was still a good man.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that. He was a good man, but he wasn't right on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got to learn to discriminate in things like that and accept people where they are.
Bishop Spong, I think it's fair to say that almost everything has changed in your theology as it has in mind. What remain the same, from my perspective, are your reverence, devotion, obedience, passion, commitment to serving other people and worshiping that which is holy. So if someone was doing a testimonial about you, if I were talking about myself, I would say if I was talking to someone that I knew was going to do my funeral, how would you want them to speak of you in a manner that would convey the changes in belief that have occurred in your life?
Well, I'm going next week down to Richmond to speak in the Lenten service. And they knew me as a priest during the 60s and 70s. And they've kept up with me because they've continued to invite me back. And so I'm still very close to those people. But it's a very different church today. And we talk about those days and the conflicts we had. And there's a lot of laughter and jokes that go on about it. The seminary I went to had as its motto, teach the truth of God, come whence it may, cost what it will. And that's guided me for a long time. And the truth of God, it cannot be encapsulated. It cannot be articulated in words. It's bigger than words. My words always limit the truth of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so you live in a world where you've got to go beyond every symbol, every statement of the past, into a mystery. You don't know what's out there, but you know that God must be out there. Whatever God is, however God is defined, I don't know what to do with that, but to be faithful. And the church I go to satisfies me about 25% of the time. I've got a wonderful rector. She's absolutely fantastic. And I suspect that if she satisfied me 50% of the time, she wouldn't satisfy her congregation. And I try to accept that as that's the best of all possible worlds. That's the best I can deal with. But I think it must be members of the church that want more. I find it all the time. We set up a lectureship in our church called the Spong Lectureship, and it's dedicated to bringing to this church people who are walking the edges, so that every year they bring someone in who's walking the edges of the Christian faith to challenge their thinking. And they do that wonderfully. They look forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not where those people are. But they are glad to know that there's a land out there where some people are wandering around that don't fit in conveniently with the church as it presently exists.
I know you always talk about the lifelong process of learning. So I'd like to ask, what did you learn during the writing of this book? How did it change you, and how do you hope it changes the way your readers think about an authentic living faith?
Well, it did change me, but not in a dramatic way. It was just a culmination of a long process that made sense. And I put it all together, and I put it in as bold terms as I knew how. And I said at the end of this book that there are going to be people who think this book is far too radical. But I believe that in 50 years or some distance in the future, it'll be determined to be not nearly radical enough. And people will be looking for more, but they'll be on a pathway that will lead them to more. At least that's my hope. I've received some really good reviews of this book. They're always by people who are uncomfortable with the church as it stands. Mm-hmm. And that's a limited audience, but that's a good audience. And I expect the book to have some of the impact that John Robinson's Honest to God had in 1963, which was a book that forced people to move out of their comfortable niche into an uncomfortable attempt to redefine Christianity. And John was a very close friend of mine and a mentor. But John's 1963 book is passé today.
Yes.
It's old hat. Everybody's been there. The difference between God as being and the ground of being. That's the stuff we've chewed on for 50 or 60 years. And we're in a new place. And we're trying to define God again in a new language. I hope we can do it, and I hope my book moves us in this direction.
The Right Reverend John Shelby Spong is the retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, a much-in-demand public speaker. He's the author of an unbelievable number of important books, a list that has grown yet again with the publication of Unbelievable: Why Neither Ancient Creeds Nor the Reformation Can Produce a Living Faith Today. Bishop Spong, it's always an honor to spend time with you and to hear your words. I thank you so much for doing this again. You are a great hero and a great model for whom we are eternally grateful.
I thank you so much for your love and support, and I'm glad to be on your program.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We appreciate your support. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.